Good morning, it's Trina Mara here and something for the weekend. And in studio, we have got the fab Ben Elton. Good morning, Ben, how are you?
I'm very well, all the better for being here, Trina. Oh,
you're such a lick. Listen, it's absolutely great to have you in. And the reason you're in is because you're doing a new stand-up show at the Olympia in Dublin on the 27th of September. A 53-day tour, and it's kicking off here in Dublin. Well, so you don't do things by halves.
Well, actually, it's going to be 80 dates because I'm doing quite a few warm-ups prior to Dublin. I wouldn't want you to think the very first night, but they're all kind of, they're not secret, but they're small theatres, little places around the country. But I'll be doing the whole evening each night and then coming to Dublin absolutely match fit. Look, if I want to get to the people that want to see me, I've got to do the long tour. I can't play an arena. And frankly, I wouldn't want to. I've made enough money. That would not be a satisfying experience for me as an artist, for what it's worth. I'm not knocking those who do. The audiences clearly love it. Young people clearly like the idea of kind of almost a tribal gathering, all being together in the same place, all agreeing we like this thing, which is great. But I don't know what a stand-up gig would be like under such circumstances.
I have to say, the arena, comedy and arenas don't work.
They can't. I mean, on the other hand, an event can work. And I was there. I saw my favourite guy, this big American or whatever. That's fine. But my audience are older, I'm older, and I come from a generation that played theatres. And my comedy is about communication. It's about engaging with the imagination of the audience. You need to focus. You need to follow it. You can't sort of tune in and tune out. It's not about a series of jokes. I think you could probably do a series of jokes in an arena, as long as you've got a good sound system. But mine is actually about a kind of meeting of minds. Maybe it sounds pompous, but it is. And that you need a theatre. You need a human scale environment to have the human experience.
Yeah, and not see a dot on a stage somewhere up the top. How do you still have ideas after so long in the business? Because sometimes, we're all in this creative industry, and sometimes you have a day where you go, do you know what, I'm completely out of ideas.
I have many of those days. I've experienced writer's block, but I'm very fortunate. I've had a great deal of success across a lot of mediums, so I can move about and something more invigorating, a novel or a sitcom or a musical or whatever. But of course there are days like those, but you have to embrace them. I'd say to anyone out there who wants to write, it is about putting the hours in, and there will be hours of frustration, and you have to stay at your desk, and maybe the whole day will be a forlorn one. But it's that kind of gestation which eventually gets you on that proverbial roll. Art is a matter of improvisation, and you have to allow yourself the freedom, I suppose, to fail. And silence is failure in terms of creativity, I suppose. I know what those days are like, but you just get through them and get back to it again the next
day. It's important, I suppose, to live a life as well, isn't it? Material. Too many people are just locking themselves up to write, and they're like, what do I write about? There's nothing to write about if you haven't lived.
I think that's true to a certain extent. I mean, I've regularly been an artist all my life, for what it's worth, but I very early on as a stand-up stopped carrying a notebook around with me. I very quickly realised that awful thing about when you're having a laugh with your mates, or you've gone to a gallery, or you're seeing a movie or a sports match or something, and you're looking for material. I think that way leads to madness. You can't just be a journalist on your life. You can't see your life as some kind of endless feeding zone of routine. So I stopped carrying a notebook around. If it's still with me in the evening or the next day, then maybe I'll write it down. But I feel very much that I've lived a full life outside of my work. I have a family and I'm very lucky with that, and we have a lot of fun together, and I've got lots of mates, and I like to drink, and I like to walk and have holidays. So sometimes people say, are you a workaholic? I work hard when I'm working, but I have an awful lot of days off.
Do you? You take time off as well. Very important. Now, you're the co-writer on The Young Ones with Rick, and I cannot believe it's been 5 years since he passed. I was looking that up, and I was thinking to myself, it must be maybe it's 2 years. Nah. How has it been 5?
I know, it's funny. And obviously, I think about him a lot anyway, but this last few weeks, I've been really thinking about him, because you mentioned, you're playing all these dates, and I play the town halls and the town theatres, and those are the same venues that Rick and I played together on our formative years. We were young. It was exciting. We did, I think, 5 tours together, just the two of us. Rick Mayall, Ben Elton, stand-up comedy. A couple in Australia where I met my wife. Rick was with me, standing beside me when I first met my wife. So obviously I'm thinking of Rick a lot, because those were the most, when you're young, it's the most exciting time in your life, unless you're very unfortunate, is, of course, there are many children have much to deal with. But if you're lucky, youth is the most exciting time. It doesn't mean getting old is bad, some kind of second best. It isn't. But those are wonderful things. And Rick and I did what we kind of had the great privilege of being silly and wandering around a country, getting drunk and for a living. It was our living was being silly. And it was a wonderful time. And I miss him very, very much. And I know that when I go back into those theatres that we walked into together 35 years ago, astonished that we were going to be playing a 1,000-seater. Here we were, Farty and the King, as we called each. He was the King, by the way, if anyone's wondering. And yeah, I'll be missing him every day.
It was lovely, actually, when you're talking about him there. Your face just lit up talking about him.
Well, good memories. I mean, yeah. He wasn't the, you know, we had our times.
You had your rows, I'm
we
sure.
We did, but we were best of friends. I see Aid and I remained best of friends. Aid and I spent a whole day together. Only the other day went on a little pub crawl. So I'm very lucky. The people I worked with early on were genuinely friends. There was no kind of, oh, we're all so fashionable, all hung out together, you know. You know, Stephen and Hugh and Emma, and from that side of my career, the Blackaddery side, and then Rick and Aid, you know, everyone's still friends. It was a special time.
Yeah, lovely. You also obviously did Blackadder with Richard Curtis. Mm. And, you know, both of these shows had such, you know, a cult following and still have.
Yeah, yeah, still remember.
Do people come up to you all the time and they're obsessed with it?
Yeah. The Blackadder is fading very slowly. Things fade. Everything goes in the end. Even Elvis is fading. I mean, it's hard to find anyone under 35 who doesn't kind of not, who just can't understand why I'm so... Elvis is still important. No, they just don't get it. Even Elvis is fading. And one day Blackadder no doubt will. But it's going very, very slowly. And that's wonderful. You don't often get a chance to enter the subconscious of the nation as we did with Blackadder. And I feel every time anyone brings it up, I feel grateful to have been a part of something that was clearly so special to so many people. Why would anyone ever mind? Anyone wants to talk to me about Blackadder, they're welcome.
Well, there's a gang out there in the office because they were quoting lines from it the other day. It was so funny. Also, one of the big highlights, I suppose, is when you get to host big events, and you hosted the Brit Awards a couple of times as well. 1997 and 1998, by the way, I think is a great decade. I love the 90s.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, because I do a 90s show as well. That's why I love it. But, you know, everybody is watching it like a hawk. Mm. They're waiting for you, hoping that you'll mess up almost,
Isn't
I think,
funny,
these days.
That side
I don't
of
think,
human nature.
Yeah, I don't
wants...
think that kind of existed then, though,
oh,
did it?
Oh, there was always Schadenfreude, but I think a certain bitterness. I mean, I've the net has kind of democratized trolling, but I've felt I've been trolled all my life. I mean, I made a big impact, and yes, I was pretty mouthy, and a lot of people decided to get very irritated about me, and it went on for a long time, and it was quite hurtful, but you know, you got to put up with it. Those are the things. I had my platform, and that was a privilege. But certainly, the Brits was just about goodwill, and it was one of the most exciting things I've ever... I mean, I look back, it's almost like a dream to think that I was ever fashionable enough to be the host of the Brits. I was the one straight after Chris Evans.
Yeah.
I mean, I did the 97 Brits where the Spice Girls had exploded in 96, and this was their first Brits, and I introduced them. And 98, and it was the Britpop War, Oasis and Blur. Such exciting times.
Yeah.
And it's almost like a dream to me that I did that. And I hosted the Mandela concert at Wembley. There was a time when I was really at the centre of it. You get older and you get a chance to look from the outside a bit, and that's good too.
At the time, I suppose, you're so busy that you're not even thinking how massive it is. And
never,
you look back and you go, wow,
right.
I did that.
I never really appreciated, actually, at the time. I was always worried about getting it right, being understood, looking to the next gig. I was never aware of being famous. It's funny. I'd sit in a pub and Sophie, my wife, would say, you know, everybody's looking at you. And I wasn't aware of it. I've never been vain in that way. I've never been self-conscious. I guess I'm always thinking about stuff. And so I'm not thinking about what other people are thinking. But it's true to say it's only retrospectively that I recognise just how big it was. And that's given me a better understanding of putting up with all the trolling. Because, you know, at the time I thought, why is everyone being so mean? But of course, if you're that central, then of course you're going to be a target.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to accept that.
There was a great moment actually at the Brit Awards where the late Caroline Hearn presented as Mrs. Merton. She set the line, and I'm sure you nearly died when she said this. Could Charlie make himself known? Everybody's looking for him backstage.
Charlie, yeah, she was very wicked. I mean, of course, Caroline Hearn, I had the privilege of knowing her slightly. We were friends, didn't know her well, but yeah, she's truly great, but a troubled person. There's this, I think she more fulfilled the idea of what people think great comic artists are, which is troubled and a little plagued by depression and things. I can't speak for it, but I think that's public knowledge.
Mm.
But I've never felt that. I've always felt deeply well adjusted. I mean, I know people who suffer from depression. I know how serious mental illness can be. I can be sad, of course. I am a fortunate person in that I am generally kind of relaxed about my place on the earth and my place in it. And I know lots of people who are, lots of great comics who aren't remotely tortured. In fact, the majority, as far as I can see. Rick was a very, very happy soul, I can assure you of that. I mean, you know, he had his demons and perhaps every now and then, perhaps nudge the pop a little bit too heavily. But, you know, I can't pretend I haven't been responsible for a fair bit of that myself.
And there was a moment as well in the Brit Awards where Bloom and Jerry Halliwell had to jump up on stage and ruin a moment. She had to just get the centre of attention. She's loud, isn't she?
Not as loud as Scary. Scary is called Scary for a reason. Scary is scary. Because right now, I'll say what I think. I don't care what you say, because I'm going to say it whatever. Anyway, I'm saying Scary. You can say whatever you like. The girls were wonderful. They were as friendly as they seem, and Jerry is lovely. Yes, she's loud, and as she bounced up onto the stage, she bounced out, you know. She actually came out of the top of her, you know, which was lovely, of course, but I did feel for her, but she didn't seem to mind. Yeah. I mean, I didn't feel for her. Anyway, moving on.
You obviously love music as well.
I adore pop.
Doing something like that, who are your favourite artists of all time, would you say? Have you gotten to meet them?
Self-evident, very much so. The Beatles are not just the greatest band that ever existed. They're the most potent cultural force, I think, of the 20th century. I think even more so than Chaplin in terms of popular culture. They changed more and focused more, and their impact on society was seismic, as indeed was their impact on pop and rock. But it went far greater than them, far further than their music. And yes, I have had the greatest privilege of my celebrity has been that I was able to get to not just know but become friends with the Beatles. George and I became friends, and I got to know Paul quite well as well, and we were friendly, and that for me was more than anything. I've met many, many famous people, but to actually be able to chat and hang out with the Beatles and go and visit George and Olivia, such dear, I mean, just the most beautiful human beings you could imagine. And I met them through Rick, actually. Rick and I were... if we've got time, it is a very quick, brief thing. Rick and I loved our rock and roll so much, and we'd listen to Roots Rock and Roll after every gig, Little Richard, Buddy Holly, Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee, Elvis. And one day in the mid-90s, Rick rang up and said, "Farty, get down to the Hard Rock. Carl Perkins is playing their 25th anniversary." Carl Perkins wrote Blue Suede Shoes for you people from the 90s, which was one of the founding pillars of rock and roll. Anyway, we went down and Carl Perkins is on stage and George Harrison is sitting in with him. So I watched George Harrison play. I can't believe it. This is as good as it's ever going to get. Except half an hour later, I'm at the bar. There's a bit of a fuffle. There's George Harrison standing in front of me. "Thanks for keeping us amused in the 80s. And we got talking and we became friends. And
oh my goodness,
I'll never, ever, ever meet a hero like that.
Were you very much in awe then? I mean, how do you go from being a fan to being friendly?
I'm quite good at that. My wife's always... I am... Because I think I have sort of an understanding of how people are feeling. I know that we all... I think as a comedian, one of the first lessons I learned was that if I'm feeling it, everyone's feeling it. That's not arrogant. It's just, you know, what... You know, simple things. A wine waiter, you know, "Would you like to taste the wine?" Well, you know nothing about the wine, and you know he knows nothing about it, but we all go through the ritual together and you have the
sip. And we pretend, fine.
And we think about it for a split second. Well, it's fine. You know, I'm not in human awe of heroes. I'm in artistic awe, but I know that George Harrison is standing there as a human being, also wondering about, you know, maybe he'll think I'm an old, you know, I'm quite relaxed around greatness, which seems like a terribly complacent thing to see, but I have been around greatness and I've been around awfulness, and I'm equally relaxed about both, because I do know that we share human beings, no matter how exalted or how small, all share 99% of their humanity, and that's something you should remember when talking to somebody very famous, that he or she also worries about how they're coming across and how they're being perceived, and also wanting to be liked or maybe wanting to be understood. So no.
And wanting friends not just because they're famous but because they're a person.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I didn't have to act that, because I felt an immediate bond and simpatico, and of course it never went away, that, you know, particularly with Paul, you know, you are obviously in the presence of the most famous artist on the planet. But nonetheless, I don't find it too difficult to be natural with people, because that's, in a way, my job is understanding our common humanity, and I feel it from my soul.
Ben, thank you so much for coming in. I could talk to you all day.
Well, I wish you'd
stick around. Thank you so much for popping in. You're going to be at the Olympia on the 27th of September, and we'll make sure to catch you there. And you've got books out. You've got so much to talk to you about. You'll have
novel.
To pop in again.
Well, I'd love to come back.
Tell me
the
about
meantime.
The new book.
Oh, well, the new novel is Identity Crisis. It's been a big hit in the UK, I think also in Ireland. Again, a look at our fractured society in a time where we seem to be at each other's throats in an age of outrage. I think it's time to celebrate our common humanity, and we can do that through comedy and humour, and I always have done in my new novel, and of course on stage at the Olympia, when I hope your listeners will think about coming and joining
Everybody's offended with everything, aren't they?
Are they, or are they just acting offended? The news isn't fake, but the outrage is. That's what my thing. You meet people in the street, they're not at each other's throats. You get on a net and everybody appears to be wanting to kill each other.
Oh yes, the keyboard warriors. We love them.
Exactly.
Thanks, Ben. This is Something for the Weekend. It's Classic Hits.